Chapter 57. The robo-guards alerted their security command to the strange drama in the garden before Pitt had lifted the tilt turban clear of the hedged confine. At first, the robot's warning was discounted as a malfunction of visual perception. But when an immediate search failed to turn up Suma, the security command offices became a scene of frenzied confusion. Because of his monumental ego and fetish for secrecy, Hideki Suma had failed to groom a top-level executive team to act in an emergency if he was beyond reach. In panic, his security directors turned to Kamatori, but quickly discovered all private phones and pages went unanswered, nor were signals to his personal roboguards acknowledged. A special defense team, backed by 4 armed robots, rushed to Kamatori's quarters. The officer in charge knocked loudly, but receiving no reply, he stepped aside and ordered one of the robots to break in the locked door. The thick-etched glass partition was quickly smashed into fragments. The officer cautiously stepped through the empty video viewing room and advanced slowly into the trophy room, his jaw dropping in stunned disbelief. Moro Kamatori hung, shoulders hunched over, in an upright position, his eyes wide open and blood streaming from his mouth. His face was contorted in pain and rage. The officer stared vacuously at the hilt of a saber protruding from Kamatori's groin, the blade running through his body and pinning him to the wall. Like a man in a daze, the officer could not believe he was dead, and gently shook Kamatori and talked to him. After a minute, it finally broke through that the born-too-late samurai warrior wasn't going to speak again, ever. And then, for the first time, the officer realized the prisoners were gone, and Kamatori's roboguards were frozen where they stood. The confusion was magnified by the news of Kamatori's killing and the almost simultaneous explosion on Level 5. The ground-to-air missiles installed around the island rose from their hidden bunkers, poised and ready for launch, but put on hold due to the uncertainty of Suma's presence on the plain. But soon the action became purposeful and controlled. The remote video recordings of the roboguards were replayed, and it was clearly seen that Suma was forced aboard the aircraft. The aging leader of the Gold Dragons, Korori Yoshishu, and his financial power force, Ichiro Tsuboi, were in Tsuboi's offices in Tokyo when the call came from Suma's security director. The 2 partners of Suma immediately assumed full command of the situation. Within 8 minutes after the explosion, Tsuboi used his considerable influence with the Japanese military to scramble a flight of jet fighters to chase the fleeing tilt turban. His orders were to intercept and attempt to force the plane back to Soseki Island. Failing in this, they were to destroy the craft and everyone on board. Tsuboi and Yoshishu agreed that, despite their long friendship with Suma, it was better for the Kaiten Project and their new empire that he should die than become a tool for foreign policy blackmail. Or worse, scandalized as a criminal under the American justice system. And then there was the frightening certainty that Suma would be forced to reveal details of Japan's secret technology and plans for economic and military supremacy to U.S. intelligence interrogation experts. Pitt took a compass heading on the position where the ship was cruising when he'd taken off for Soseki Island. He pushed the engines dangerously past their limit as Lauren tried desperately to make contact with the Bennett. "I can't seem to raise them," she said in frustration. "You on the right frequency?" "16 VF?" "Wrong band. Switch to 16 UF and use my name as our call sign." Lauren selected the ultra-high frequency band and dialed the frequency. Then she spoke into the microphone attached to her headset. "Pitt calling USS Bennett," she said. "Pitt calling the Bennett. Do you hear me? Do you hear me? Please answer." "This is the Bennett?" The voice replied so loud and clear it nearly blasted out Lauren's eardrums through the headset. "Is that really you, Mr. Pitt? You sound as if you had a sex change since we last saw you." The aircraft had been scanned by the Bennett's super-sensitive detection systems from the moment it left the ground. Once it was perceived as heading over the sea to the east, it was tracked by a tactical electronic warfare and surveillance receiver system. Within minutes of being alerted, Commander Harper was pacing the deck in the Situation Room. He stopped every few seconds and peered over the shoulders of the console operators who stared into the radar screens and the computer monitor that analyzed and measured the signals and enhanced the approaching target into a recognizable classification. "Can you distinguish?" "Either a tilt rotor or a new tilt turbine," the operator anticipated Harper. "It lifted like a helicopter, but it's coming on too fast for rotor blades." "Heading?" 120. "Looks to be on a course toward the position where we launched the 2 Ibises." Harper swung to a phone and picked it up. "Communications." "Communication, sir," a voice answered instantly. "Any radio signals?" "None, sir. The airwaves are quiet." "Call me the second you receive anything. Harper slammed down the phone. Any course change? Target still flying on a 120 heading slightly south of east, Captain. It had to be, but it couldn't be Pitt, Harper thought. But who else would fly toward that particular position? A coincidence, he wondered. Not one to run on idle, he barked an order to his executive officer who was standing at his side. Turn on a course toward the position where we launched the Ibises. Full speed until I tell you different. The officer knew Harper preferred efficiency to traditional protocol, so he turned without acknowledging and speedily relayed the orders to the bridge. Communications for you, Captain, announced a seaman. Harper snatched the phone. This is the Captain. I have a signal from a woman claiming to be Congresswoman Lauren Smith. She also claims Mr. Pitt is at the controls of an aircraft hijacked from Soseki Island, carrying 8 passengers, including Senator Michael Diaz and Mr. Hideki Suma. Too far down the chain of command to be informed of the abductions of Lauren and Diaz, Harper could not be blamed for a lack of credence. They hijacked an airplane and snatched Suma? And where in hell did Pitt dig up a pair of politicians on Soseki Island? He paused to shake his head in wonderment, then gave an order over the phone. Tell whoever you're in contact with that I require more concrete identification. The communication specialist came back within half a minute. The woman swears she's Congresswoman Lauren Smith of Colorado, and if we don't guide them in and provide protection in the event they're pursued, she's going to lunch with Roy Monroe and demand you're put in command of a tugboat in the Arctic. I'm not one to offer advice to the captain, sir, but if she's friendly with the Secretary of the Navy, she must be who she says she is. All right, I'll buy her story, for now. Harper reluctantly caved in. Give instructions to turn 20 degrees south and continue on a westerly heading until we meet up. I have 2 aircraft rising from Senzu Air Base, the console operator monitoring the tactical receiver system broke in. Configuration and speed indicate Mitsubishi Raven interceptors of the Japanese Air Self-Defense Force. They've turned onto the same heading as the tilt turbine and are probing with radar. Damn it, Harper burst. Now we've got the Jap military to deal with. He turned to his exec again. Apprise Pacific Command of our situation. Inform them I am going on combat mode. I intend to fire on the pursuers if they show any indication of a hostile act. I'm taking on the responsibility of protecting those people in the tilt turbine aircraft in the belief they're American nationals. His executive officer hesitated. Aren't you going out on a limb, sir? Not too far out. Harper smiled shrewdly. Do you seriously think I'll be court-martialed for shooting down hostile aircraft to save the lives of 2 members of Congress? Harper's logic was unarguable. The executive officer smiled back. No, sir, I don't guess you would. Pitt took the aircraft up to 4,000 meters and held it there. The time for hugging the surface of the sea was past. He was out of range of the island's missile systems, and now had a straight shot at the Ralph R. Bennett. He relaxed and donned the radio headset and microphone that was hanging on the arm of his seat. 80 kilometers to go, he said quietly. She should be coming into sight dead ahead. Giordino had relieved Lauren in the co-pilot's seat and was studying the fuel gauges with a bemused eye. Suma's ground crew was pretty stingy with the gas. We'll be on fumes in another 10 minutes. They only needed to partially fill the tanks for the short hop from Soseki and back from Edo City, said Pitt. I've pushed her hard and used up fuel at an extravagant rate. You better take it easy and conserve. There was a click in their earphones, and a deep voice came through. This is Commander Harper. Nice to hear from you, Commander. This is Dirk Pitt. Go ahead. I hate to be the bearer of grim tidings, but you've got a pair of Japanese mosquitoes chasing your tail. What next? Muttered Pitt in exasperation. How soon before they intercept? Our computers say they'll be sitting in your lap 12 to 15 kilometers before we rendezvous. We're dead meat if they attack, Giordino said, tapping the fuel gauges. You're not as bad off as you think, Harper said slowly. Our electronic countermeasures are already jamming their radar missile guidance systems. They'll have to be almost on top of you to go on visual. Got anything you can throw at them to spoil their aim? Our only weapon is a 30-millimeter Sea Vulcan. Not much better than a pea-shooter, Giordino complained. I'll have you know that pea-shooter, as you call it, can spit 4,200 rounds a minute as far as 8 kilometers, Harper shot back. A good 5 kilometers too short, too late, said Pitt. Got any other ideas? Hang on. 2 full minutes passed before Harper spoke. You might make it under our fire cover if you put your craft into a dive and pull out on the deck. The increased speed during your descent will give you an extra 4 minutes of lead time. No advantage I can see, said Giordino. Our pursuers will dive, too. Negative, Pitt replied to Harper. We'll be like a helpless duck gliding over the waves. Better to remain at an altitude where I still have airspace to maneuver. They're pretty smart fellas, retorted Harper. They've planned ahead. We tracked them closing at an altitude of 1,200 meters, 2,800 meters below you. Looks to me like they figure to cut you off at the pass. Keep talking. If you use the tactics created by our computers, you increase your odds of making it under our umbrella of fire. Also, and this is a vital issue, once they come within range of our Vulcan, we'll have an open field of fire above you. I'm persuaded, said Pitt. We'll begin descent in 40 seconds. He turned to Lauren, who was sitting in the seat directly behind the cockpit door. See that everyone straps in good and tight. We're going to rock and roll for a little while. Lauren quickly made the rounds of the cabin, checking on Suma and Toshier, alerting the others. Any joy shared among the survivors of the mate team quickly faded as a dark mood settled over the cabin. Only the Japanese industrialist looked suddenly happy. Suma smiled the smile of a carved Buddha. In the cockpit, Pitt briefly went through a stretching routine to relieve muscle tension and loosen his joints. He took a series of deep breaths, and then he massaged his hands and fingers as if he was a concert pianist about to attack Liszt's Second Hungarian Rhapsody. 18 kilometers and closing fast, said Harper's voice. Pitt gripped the wheel on the control column and nodded at Giordino. Al, read out the airspeed and altitude readings. My pleasure, Giordino said without the slightest note of excitement. His faith in Pitt was total. Pitt pressed the transmit button on his radio. Commencing dive, he said in the tone of a pathologist announcing an incision on a corpse. Then he took a firm grip on the wheel and eased the control column forward, wondering what he would say when he met the devil. The aircraft nosed over and down, its jet engine screaming as it hurtled toward the vast blue sea that filled the entire expanse of the cockpit's windshield.